Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Gutierrez, and we appreciate the flexibility of counsel in reordering this morning's cases. Counsel for the government. You may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Captain Trevor Nelson, along with Colonel John Miller II. We represent the government as appellant in this case. At trial, defense counsel said, "Your Honor, I simply do not want to request a mistake of fact instruction for battery." That statement, Your Honors, constitutes an affirmative, calculated, and designed course of action by defense counsel. That is as clear a request for affirmative waiver that a military judge is likely to hear or an appellate court is likely to review. That statement, that request, in light of Akeley's confession to grabbing his victim's arm and touching her body after she said, "No, stop," constitutes an affirmative waiver.
Was the LIO given for battery?
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge instructed in the lesser included offense of assault consummated by a battery.
So can defense counsel waive an affirmative defense?
Yes, Your Honor. A defense counsel can waive an affirmative defense.
The judge isn't required to give it no matter what?
Your Honor, the military judge is required to give an instruction in all defenses, all instructions reasonably raised by the evidence. However, a defense counsel has a right to request a waiver of an affirmative defense or a mistake of fact instruction, as in this case.
Where is that in the plain language of Rule 920, for example?
Your Honor, I point to the case of United States versus Smith, where this court held that affirmative waiver is applicable. And in instances where defense counsel's strategies, for example, an all or nothing defense.
Right. I asked you about the rule, though. Where in the rule does it say you can waive an affirmative defense if the evidence suggests it?
Your Honor, the rule does not say that explicitly. However, RCM 920 recognizes that defense counsel has a right to try the case based on how the evidence, he or she sees the evidence, in the most effective way.
That best serves the interests of justice if there's some evidence. So you give the LIO and there's some evidence that there's a defense, but the judge, which therefore in theory may create a reasonable doubt. But having given the LIO, the judge is free to not give an affirmative defense.
If the military judge is convinced that the defense counsel has making a calculated and taking a design course of action based on a tactical decision not to request a lesser-included instruction, a lesser-included offense, or in this case, a mistake of fact instruction, yes, the military judge has that discretion to forego giving that instruction. And that's exactly what happened in this case. The Army Court erred in finding that this was not waiver. As I mentioned earlier, the court in U.S. v. Smith, where appellant pled guilty to an indecent act and not guilty to rape and sodomy, defense counsel requested a limited instruction whereby the panel member would consider his plea in light of additional evidence on the sodomy and indecent act charges. This court said that an affirmative waiver to a lesser included offense of indecent act to rape and sodomy.
But that was an LIO. That wasn't an affirmative defense, was it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there's lots of case law that says you can waive the LIO. But what about case law that says once the LIO is given, the judge can sit on his hands in light of, even if there's some evidence that there's an affirmative defense to the LIO?
No, I'll point to United States v. Moore, 1962 case, where there was a charge for unpremeditated murder, and the question was whether or not the military judge should have instructed on the lesser included offense of voluntary manslaughter. And here, this court held that it was not waiver where defense counsel specifically indicated to the military judge that he was not requesting that instruction. And here our position is essentially one is that whether it's a lesser included defense or it's an affirmative defense raised by the evidence, defense counsel rules RCM 920 to recognize that defense counsel has the ability to ask for waiver. Essentially, a defense counsel is allowed to try the case the way he or she sees fit. What has happened here in this case is that the Army Court is second-guessing defense counsel's strategy as to how the evidence came on the trial.
Counsel, what's the possible defense strategy here? The case law that recognizes waiver of lesser included instructions reflects circumstances in which the defense counsel makes a calculated strategic consideration that typically they'll want all or nothing on the charged offense. They don't want to give the members any encouragement to find the accused guilty of a lesser included offense. But if the defense has not waived the lesser included offense, and they've tried the case on mistake of fact, and they've obtained mistake of fact instructions on the primary offenses, what would be the strategic reason for not requesting or not wanting a mistake of fact instruction on the lesser offense?
Your Honor, in this case, the defense counsel was boxed in by the evidence. Essentially, in his statement, which was admitted into evidence, the appellee said, after the victim told him to stop, he still grabbed her arm and touched her body. Now, the way defense counsel tried this case, the fight was really on the more serious offenses, the charged offense assault with intent to commit rape and the lesser included indecent assault. However, he was boxing by the evidence. The fact that the appellant, the appellee, said in the statement that he did touch the victim after she told him to stop, given the context of how that evidence was presented to panel members, there's no way defense counsel could have gotten up and argued in a credible way that the appellee was not guilty of that offense. So essentially, in the choice between whether or not he was facing a conviction of the more serious offenses versus assault consummated by a battery, defense counsel thought it was an applicable strategic decision for him to not request that instruction. Because if you look at what the instructions would have been, Your Honor, with respect to the mistake of fact or assault consummated by a battery, basically it would suggest that any touching would have been reasonable. Now, given the context of the evidence that the athlete said he touched the victim after she told him to stop, that would be a pretty long stretch for the panel members to believe that even in that context, that touching would have been reasonable. So essentially, he was boxing by the evidence, and he made the best strategic decision that was available to him.
Did that leave the defense with an inconsistent position as to consent?
No, Your Honor, because the more serious charges of assault with intent to commit rape, that touching would have been, this surfer to be done with the intent to arouse a sexual desire, which would be different with respect to the mistake of fact and the lesser included offense of assault consummated by a battery. This court found waiver in U.S. v. Mundy, where the military judge essentially proposed what instruction he would have given to the panel members, and defense counsel merely said, Your Honor, that's not exactly what I'm asking for, but I'll go along with it. In this case, defense counsel did a lot more. Defense counsel was given a copy of the instructions. It's on record of page 88. There's indication that defense counsel indicated to the military judge exactly which instruction he was requesting prior to the judge making a decision on instructions. For example, the military judge, on several instances, made reference to, it appears that you're requesting, for example, a mistake of fact instruction as contained in Article 121. And in several more instances, he indicated that it appears if you're requested. Now, there's nothing in the record indicating that there was a request that was given by the defense counsel prior to this. So a reading of the complete reading of the record would indicate that the military judge had some indication from defense counsel what specific instruction he was requesting. And then beyond that, defense counsel raised issues regarding members that were detailed to the court-martial. He argued for vigorous cost challenges to court-martial panel members, and he did not hesitate to ask for recess to discuss issues regarding prosecution exhibits. No, certainly, Your Honor, this defense counsel was not one that was asleep at the wheel, as in U.S. v. Moore, where defense counsel merely just acquiesced to what the military judge said was his opinion regarding the instruction. This record reveals a defense counsel that was actively engaged and who presented a tactically sound case. Now, at the end of the colloquy and the instruction, military judge and counsel agreed that mistake of fact was with respect to assault with intent to commit rape and indecent assault. And then the military judge made a statement, and it doesn't appear to be a mistake of fact instruction with regard to battery. Are you requesting one? He asked that question, are you requesting one? And the defense counsel responded, Your Honor, I simply do not want one for battery. This court said in U.S. v. Smith that there's no magic word required for affirmative waiver. And as I said earlier, Your Honor, this is as clear an indication that the defense counsel would be given to a military judge. The Army Court ignored the plain meaning of these words when they decided that this was not waiver of the affirmative defense.
Moore said that how do you address the defense argument with respect to the potential that the military judge mistakenly indicated to the defense counsel that there was this passive language here. There doesn't appear to be any mistake of fact instruction with respect to battery, with regard to battery, which is an accurate statement with respect to the bench book, but not necessarily an accurate statement with respect to the law. That is, why shouldn't we view the military judge's statement as telling the defense counsel there's nothing, there's no canned statement, there's no canned instruction for us to use? If that's the case, isn't it typically the responsibility of the military judge then to fashion an instruction?
Yes, Your Honor, but in this case, the military judge went one step further. He asked the additional part of that question, which was, are you requesting one? So not only was the military judge, this should be read, the Army Corps read this as to suggest that the military judge somehow was a strong arm in defense counsel. But complete reading of the exchange in this colloquy indicates more closely that what the military judge was saying is asking a question, are you going to be requesting a mistake of fact instruction with respect to battery? The military judge may have been giving his opinion with respect to, I don't see a mistake of fact instruction. Do you see one? Are you requesting one? And in the context that defense counsel had reviewed the instructions by the military judge and had given some indication of which instructions that he wanted, this certainly was not a case in which defense counsel was merely acquiescing to the military judge's assertion. In Monday, this court found that there was a waiver in a situation where the defense counsel merely said he was leaving it up to the military judge's opinion as to whether or not a mistake of fact instruction should have been given. This is not the circumstances that we have here, Your Honor. We have a defense counsel who was actively engaged throughout the process, and this presented a tactically sound case. Not only that, but the evidence curtailed the strategy which the defense counsel was applying in this particular case. The law is waiver. We look at the language, the plain meaning of the language. It's not waiver and an explanation. Defense counsel is not required to disclose any tactical decision. Now, the Army Court, someone suggests that there was no trial strategy on the part of defense counsel. But I'll give you one. Defense counsel here is facing a situation where his client would most likely have to, if he gets convicted of assault with intent to commit rape, he's looking at 20 years in that kind of discharge versus the LIO of indecent assault, 5 years and a dishonorable discharge. Now, not only that, but the implication of that, that he would have to register under Mabin's law as a sex offender. That is a far more unappealing situation than if he's convicted for assault consummated by a battery. So in the context of the fact that he gave the statement admitting that he touched the victim after she told him, no, stop, makes perfect sense. Not only that, but on his closing argument, defense counsel raised no issue with respect to assault consummated by a battery. He left that out. He didn't argue that in his closing argument. His focus, his fight, was on the more serious offense of assault with intent to commit rape and indecent assault. In Monday, this court cited to Justice Douglas' opinion in Johnson versus United States, a case also involving affirmative waiver of instruction. Here, Justice Douglas said, the range of waiver is wide. We're not dealing here with an inadvertence or oversight. We cannot permit an accused to elect to pursue a particular course as strategy at trial, then insist on a different course on appeal, having found out that that course was not successful. In this case, Your Honor, the appellee chose a successful course at trial. He presented a tactically sound case, and he won his case. This case was fought with respect to the more serious offenses, and that proved to be a good decision on the part of defense counsel. Regardless of whether the Army Court of Criminal Appeals disagreed with defense counsel's choice of waiver of an instruction, the plain meaning of defense counsel language, Your Honor, I simply do not want to request one for battery, should be given an effect. If there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. You have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Please the court. My name is Captain Patrick Grant, and Colonel Stephen Hendricks and I represent the appellee Juan Gutierrez. The Army Court correctly held that the defense counsel did not affirmatively waive the mistake of fact instruction as it applied to assault consummated by battery. Because mistake of fact is an affirmative defense, it is a required instruction, and it can only be waived by affirmative action by the defense counsel. Moreover, the record must reflect a calculated and designed course of action for the defense counsel to forego the instruction. Here, the defense counsel did not waive the instruction for three reasons. First, the defense counsel was obviously confused in discussing how mistake of fact applied to general versus specific intent crimes. Second, the defense counsel had no tactical reason to waive the instruction. And finally, there's not enough discussion on the record to indicate a calculated and designed course of action to waive the instruction. Now, I refer you to page 214 of the record, where the military judge and defense counsel start discussing mistake of fact. And it starts off on line 15 by the military judge asking the defense counsel, do you see any mistake of fact instruction on the evidence before the court? Yes, Your Honor. What would that mistake of fact be? A mistake of fact as to consent, Your Honor. Keep in mind here that the accused, the primary offense, is assault with intent to commit rape, a specific intent crime. And yet here's the defense counsel starting to ask, or he's focusing on the general intent element. And the military judge then responds, well, wouldn't it be a different instruction? I apologize. I don't understand, Your Honor. There's obviously confusion here on part of the defense counsel. And there's no list here, as the government indicates, that the defense is reading already. Certainly no, it's not in the appellate exhibits. The military judge is just reacting to the defense counsel asking for the wrong type of instruction. Again, in discussing the lesser-included offense of indecent assault, the defense counsel again, but Your Honor, isn't indecent assault a specific intent crime? And again, the military judge then has to explain, but you're asking it for the general intent element of intent to do bodily harm. And this goes on for four pages of the record of trial, where the military judge teaches the defense counsel how mistake of fact applies to general versus specific intent crime. And it is only after this four-page lesson where the defense counsel acquiesces no less than 16 times to what the military judge is saying that they then turn to the instruction at issue, where he says, well, it appears that mistake of fact doesn't apply to battery. Are you requesting an instruction? And the defense counsel, in a confused response, merely states, Your Honor, defense simply doesn't request one for battery. Considering the context in which this statement was made, that statement is clearly not a designed and calculated course of action. Rather, it is a mere off-the-cuff acquiescence to the military judge's erroneous statement of law.
So where is the mistake of instruction, mistake of fact instruction with respect to battery?
Excuse me?
Where is the mistake of fact instruction with respect to battery?
Are you asking where it is in the benchmarking room?
Where is it anywhere? Where would one look for it?
I believe it's in Chapter 5 of the benchmark, Your Honor. Certainly, he's focusing on the general intent element here of intent to do bodily harm, which can be negated by mistake of fact. And certainly, you can adopt the instructions in Chapter 5 of the benchmark to fit that.
One would have to, in effect, construct an instruction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Do you agree with the government that you could affirmatively waive?
Your Honor, the rule certainly does not apply for affirmative waiver of the defense. Clearly, the cases deal with lesser-included instructions, and that's simply all we have to deal with, Your Honor.
What's your position?
Yes, Your Honor, he can affirmatively waive the instruction, but it definitely has to be a designed and calculated course of action, and that we simply don't have that here. And this brings me to my next point.
So if the LIO is given, your position is that the defendant can waive it for waive the mistake of fact instruction for tactical reasons?
Yes, Your Honor, he can. And clearly here, the defense counsel had no tactical reason to waive this instruction. Consider, for instance, that indecent assault, for which the military judge did instruct from a mistake of fact, and assault consummated by battery share the common element of intent to do bodily harm. A mistake of fact is an absolute defense for that element. Not only does it share the same legal requirement, but it shares the same facts in this case, which was a touching of a breast and a touching of a vagina, to prove that element. So it makes no sense for the defense to assert the mistake of fact instruction for indecent assault, but yet waive it for assault consummated by battery. And in fact, the defense, when you consider his theory of the case here, he certainly never did abandon mistake of fact. Indeed, during a voir dire, he addressed the panel members. A mistake concerning consent would be a defense in this case and will require a finding of not guilty. Again, he's referring to that common element when he's saying consent. He again returns to the theme in opening argument, stating we know through human experience that people make mistakes, that sometimes they misperceive situations, that people misperceive what other people are doing. That is what this case is about, mistakes that were made, but no crime was committed. And significantly, even after discussion instructions with the military judge, the defense counsel returns to the mistake of fact theme in his closing argument, stating what you should also consider is the mistake that he made that night, the mistake of fact concerning consent. Again, focusing on the consent element. So this isn't the type of case that Justice Douglas warned against, where the defense intentionally foregoes a path at trial and then complains on appeal that it was never open to him. Because here the defense counsel stuck with mistake of fact, mistake of fact, mistake of fact, without the entire trial.
The government has suggested a sequential element to this, that is that the mistake of fact evidence was and focus was on the sexually related offenses, but that the battery itself took place after comments were made, and that it was a different situation, and therefore the defense didn't want the mistake of fact defense raised at that point in a manner that would apparently confused the members on that issue. So how would you respond to that in terms of the evidence that was presented at trial?
Your Honor, you should look at the way the military judge did, in fact, instruct the members. Here, as I said earlier, it is the same element for indecent assault and assault consummated by battery, and it is the same facts that the government presented to prove that element, which was the touching of her breast and the touching of the vagina. So it's the same facts for the same element, Your Honor.
Counsel, I understand your argument in regard to this instruction and the defense lack of a overall tactic. But if you look at the record on page 214, there the defense attorney requested an instruction on voluntary intoxication for assault with intent to rape and indecent assault, but specifically requested that there not be an instruction on involuntary intoxication for the battery. Now, that seems consistent with what he did on the mistake of fact instruction, and it seems to bolster the government's argument that whatever it was, there was a tactic here.
Well, Your Honor, again, by not requesting the voluntary intoxication, again, that's a specific intent. It has to be a specific intent crime to be a defense, and here assault consummated by battery is not a specific intent defense, so it wouldn't apply to that anyway, Your Honor. Finally, Your Honor, there's simply not enough discussion here on the record to indicate a calculated and designed course of action. Again, you have merely these two lines from the military judge, and it's an erroneous statement of law. Well, this simply doesn't apply, and the defense counsel is responding, well, I don't request one. For example, in United States v. Smith, the military judge there held an 802 session to discuss how...
I don't think the military judge said it doesn't apply.
No, Your Honor. He said
there's a statement which is at least ambiguous, that one might interpret it as it doesn't apply, or one might interpret it as the bench book doesn't have it. Would you agree with that?
But he says it appears a mistake of fact. I'm sorry, and there doesn't appear to be any mistake of fact instruction with regard to battery. Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I was just simply paraphrasing what he was saying.
But counsel, let me bring you back to the instruction on it. Involuntary intoxication or voluntary intoxication. There, the military judge used language that you would have liked him to use probably in the mistake of fact instruction. He said it would not apply at your request to the lesser offense of battery. And so that indicates that it would not apply because of the request of the defense attorney, rather than it would not apply as a matter of law.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, he certainly didn't do that, though, when it came to the instruction on battery. And as I said earlier, when they're discussing the mistake of fact, the defense counsel is clearly confused as to how this defense applies. That's how I distinguish that from requesting the voluntary intoxication instruction, Your Honor. Now, again, as I was saying, there's simply not enough discussion on the record to show a calculated and designed course of action. For example, in United States v. Smith, the military judge held an 802 session where she discussed how she would instruct the panel members regarding the way the accused pled guilty. And further, before instructing, she held another Article 39A session where the defense counsel specifically asked the military judge if she would instruct them on the elements. The military judge gave a proposed instruction. The defense counsel responded, well, that's close enough, Your Honor. There, unlike there, where there was significant detailed discussion on that specific instruction at issue, here there's very little discussion. And the discussion that we have does not indicate a calculated and designed course of action. And in fact, by the defense counsel saying, I simply don't request one for battery, should just be considered that, a failure to request an instruction. However, a failure to request an instruction does not relieve the military judge of a sua sponte duty to give one. Moreover, this court should consider that when the military judge wanted an affirmative waiver, he certainly knew how to ask for it. On page 214 of the record...
You said he had a sui sponte duty before you told me he didn't. Which is it?
Your Honor, he does have a sua sponte duty under 920E to instruct on affirmative defenses. However, the defense counsel can affirmatively waive that instruction.
He can waive the military judge's affirmative duty to do something.
This court has certainly recognized... The military judge also has a sua sponte duty to instruct on lesser included offenses. This court certainly recognized affirmative waiver in that regard, Your Honor.
But the LIO having been given, the judge can then pick and choose what he does.
Absent an affirmative waiver, no, he cannot, Your Honor. He must give that instruction. And here we simply do not have the affirmative waiver. Absent any other further questions, I would like to conclude.
Thank you.
Defense counsel stated that he simply does not request a mistake of fact instruction for battery. It was a mere off-the-cuff acquiescence to the military judge's erroneous statement of law. Considering the lack of detail when discussing the instruction, the context or the confusion of the defense counsel as how mistake of fact applied, the fact that defense counsel had no tactical reason to waive the instruction and stuck with the theory of mistake of fact throughout his entire case, his statement cannot be seen as a calculated and designed course of action. Therefore, this court should affirm the Army Court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Does the government have any rebuttal?
Your Honor, the actor here ignores the confession that he made to CID that was admitted in evidence, where he said he continued to touch the victim, grabbing her arms and her body after she said, stop. That's the reason there was a difference between mistake of fact as how it applied to the assault consummated by a battery and the sex offenses of assault with intent to commit rape. The military judge gave an instruction. He gave the general intent instruction on the assault with intent to commit, on the recent assault. The instruction was that the accused mistakenly believed that PFC Mess consented to him touching her breast and vagina, and if such belief on his part was reasonable. So he gave, and you know, with respect to the application of a mistake of fact defense, it may vary as even there's a specific intent crime as to whether or not you give the general intent instruction or the specific intent instruction. Here the judge gave a general intent instruction.
The defense response to my question was that the facts and the elements, the facts were the same with respect to both the lesser included and the greater offense. So there wouldn't have been a tactical reason in terms of having a different sequence of events at issue.
And the defense is wrong here, Your Honor, because he ignores the fact that it was a confession. So everything that happened before the victim told the appellee to stop would have related to the assault with intent to commit rape and the recent assault. After he continued to touch her when she said stop, that part would have been related to assault consummated by a battery. And that's how we made a distinction.
Those weren't indecent assaults either after she told him to stop?
Your Honor, our position is that that would have gone to assault with intent to commit, the assault consummated by a battery. It's not applicable to the more serious offense of a recent assault.
So it's the government's position that all the activity that took place after she told him to stop was not assault with intent to commit an indecent act?
No, Your Honor. Our position is that from a tactical standpoint as to how the defense counsel tried this case.
I'm not asking a tactical question. I'm asking whether the offense itself changed once she said stop.
No, Your Honor, the nature of the funds didn't essentially change. Our position is from a tactical standpoint, the way the defense counsel approached this case, he treated the portion that came after the appellee was told to stop. He treated that portion as going to assault.
And what specifically would you point us to where the defense counsel changed tactics and asked the members to, asked the court marshal to view the facts differently as a result of her saying stop?
Well, Your Honor, defense counsel's tactic easily changed in the course of the trial. Here he started off with requesting suppression of the appellee's statement. Now, having failed in that strategy, then he had to move to the next best course of outcome, as you could see at that particular point. Now, very well, he may have started off with an all-or-nothing defense. It's going to be a mistake of fact all the way through. But having argued for suppression of the appellee statement, which he lost, then he was forced to change his tactical position. And the government contention, that's the reason why he asked for mistake of fact with respect to the two more serious offenses, and then declined it, specifically declined it.
I understand your theoretical argument. My question, what in the record shows that the defense said, here's a break point. It's indecent before this, it's simple battery after that.
Well, Your Honor, the defense counsel didn't spell it out. Okay. And from a tactical standpoint, probably wouldn't be necessary for him to do it. It's very well that the panel members could have come back with a not guilty on all of the charges, including, of course, the more serious and a lesser included offense. So he left it up to the panel members to decide without necessarily spelling that out in evidence.
Okay.
Where did the Army Court go wrong here, Your Honors? First, the Army Court wanted to retry the case. They added their own spin with respect to the meaning of the plain language used by defense counsel requesting the waiver. Suddenly, the court decided that the military judge was somehow strong-arming and used strong-arm tactics in defense counsel, and he was merely acquiescing. And they insisted that their decision complied or comport with their own theories of the case, ignoring completely whatever tactical decision may be used by defense counsel. This battle, as I said before, on the case was on the more serious offenses. And defense counsel and the appellee won with respect to that. They won their case. There's simply no basis for the Army Court to base their decision on the fact that this was not an affirmative waiver. As such, this court should set aside the Army Court's decision and reinstate appellee's conviction for assault consummated by a battery.
Thank you very much. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the court will stand in recess until 9:40 a.m. this morning. Second case this morning, United States against Perez. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. I am Frank Spinner, and together with my co-counsel, Captain Romer, we represent the appellant, Rafael Perez, in this case, and I'm glad to be here this morning. Basically, the issue that was granted in this case of ineffective assistance of counsel that stretches from the findings portion of the trial through to the sentencing portion of the trial through to the post-trial submissions involving clemency. My client released his Army defense counsel on the advice of his civilian defense counsel, Mr. Woodward, and then proceeded to trial without military counsel. In this case, the civilian defense counsel made no opening statement at the beginning of the trial. He made no opening statement once he began to present his case. He did not challenge various aspects of evidence. And then he called the victim as a defense witness. And in closing argument, he brought out evidence against his client through that witness. And then in his closing argument, he essentially vouched for the credibility of that witness. In particular, and perhaps the most egregious part of that, is that even though my client was charged with multiple rapes and had any confession offered in evidence and admitted by the court, had admitted having sexual intercourse with the victim, stepdaughter. He'd made no admission that he raped her at Fort Hood. There were basically three different locations here. Fort Leonard Wood, in Missouri, Fort Wainwright in Alaska, and finally Fort Hood, where the final allegations were brought forth. My client made no admission that he engaged in sexual intercourse with her at Fort Hood. And yet, the civilian attorney argued in closing that the witness was credible that she had had sexual intercourse with my client at Fort Hood. Now, she claimed At one place in her written statement, which was admitted, and which was at least contested by defense counsel, that there was sexual intercourse on multiple occasions at Fort Hood. When she testified, she basically said that she recalled only one occasion at Fort Hood. My client admitted no sexual intercourse with her at Fort Hood, and yet the defense counsel appeared to concede sexual intercourse at that location. Now, it gets a little confusing because there were allegations of indecent acts at all three locations. There were allegations of sodomy at all three locations. There were allegations of rape on diverse occasions, only at Fort Wainwright and Fort Hood. The judge did acquit my client of the indecent acts at Fort Hood. He acquitted my client of sodomy at Fort Hood, and he basically found him, my client, guilty of rape at Fort Hood, accepting the language diverse occasions. Now, it didn't get any better after trial. After trial, well, first of all, at sentencing, Mr. Woodward did not call any military witnesses to testify in sentencing on behalf of my client. The only two individuals, well, there were basically three submissions at sentencing: an unsworn statement by my client, a testimony by his wife, and then the defense again called the victim to the stand to testify. He put on no evidence. Church members, former military associates who worked with and knew my client's record. He didn't even ask the government to hold First Sergeant Kenneth Wright. First Sergeant Wright testified during the suppression motion phase of the trial. He was called as a government witness for that purpose. Now, in his testimony, he did make some very favorable comments regarding my client. So it only stands to reason that Mr. Woodward would have would not have released First Sergeant Wright, but would have kept him there to testify in sentencing, given the glowing statements that he made. And yet, he did not do so. So it appears that, and in the affidavit submitted by my client to the lower court, my client said he asked Mr. Woodward to locate, interview, and obtain a number of witnesses. He says he provided a list of names. In fact, this became a point of contention between the TDS attorney who was released and Mr. Woodward just before trial, because the TDS attorney was concerned that they had failed to adequately prepare for the trial and for sentencing. Then, after trial, my client has provided an affidavit to the effect that Mr. Woodward made no attempt that he knows of to contact him or talk to him about submitting clemency matters. In fact, my client made numerous attempts to contact him to find out what the plan was for clemency. He had his wife go by the attorney's office to get his attention to find out what the plan was for clemency. And basically, civilian counsel submitted a clemency letter articulating what he thought would be best without coordinating it in any form or fashion with my client. He did not even obtain a request for clemency from my client to submit to the convening authority. At the Army Court level...
Counsel, let's go back to your argument on the clemency issues. What's your argument that there was prejudice there, considering the fact that the CCA sent this case back to the convening authority for a new staff judge advocate recommendation, and when the new staff judge advocate recommendation was made, clemency material was submitted, and it was acknowledged by the convening authority in his second shot at this, and he still approved the sentence. So where do you get your prejudice on that
issue? And that's where I was going next, Your Honor. Even then, the clemency process broke down. Basically, what happened at that point, and the Army Court, without even addressing this issue, sent the case back down based on problems with the statute of advocates recommendation. Actually, we had intentionally not raised that issue because my concerns, because I wanted to focus on the issues that I thought had merit and to get real relief. But once it became clear that the Army's court was sending the case back down for a new convening authority action, I did not find out about that until after the Army TDS lawyer assigned to do the clemency had been assigned. When I became aware of who she was, I made sure that she got in contact with my client because I felt like, well, here's an opportunity now to supplement the record with these character statements that were not obtained by Mr. Woodard. I had my client provide her a list of names for that purpose. Apparently, because, and this is all, I think, somewhat recorded in the submission that was made ultimately to the convening authority. Because of time demands, other caseload and things, she apparently did not contact these individuals. She asked the convening authority, you know, through the staff judge advocate, for additional time to contact these individuals, and it was denied. She was not given additional time to contact these individuals. And I think part of the breakdown there was because she did not understand. See, she understood that they were sending it back for a new staff judge advocate's recommendation. I don't think she understood when she started to do her work that there was this other issue out there that the court had not addressed. There was some confusion in terms of what she needed to do to support the client at that point.
Counsel, if I may, Judge Irvin?
Yes.
It appears, correct me if I'm wrong, that right now we're getting testimony from you. The brief before us, does it challenge the performance of defense counsel during the second?
Oh, no.
Okay, so there's no challenge to the effectiveness of counsel at that second proceeding.
Correct, Your Honor.
And as I read the brief, there's no challenge to the clemency proceeding at the second proceeding.
Yes, there was, Your Honor. One of the issues we raised and the court did not grant review.
Right, but as far as the issues that are before us right now,
right,
we don't have that before us.
Right.
So if we didn't grant it, then you're restricted to arguing the issues that we granted.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so can we consider what happened on clemency for any reason other than an overall view of the effectiveness of counsel that was provided to your client?
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, Your Honor. I'm sure you will. When the second clemency package was submitted, that became an allied paper to the record, and that is before the court.
Yes.
And to the extent that the court wants to disregard what I just said as far as what happened, I have no problem with that. I just simply refer the court to those documents, because in those documents, the TDS captain addresses the fact that she asked for additional time to locate and interview witnesses, and that was denied. And I think that's all addressed in your submission, which is before the court.
Okay, that's fine. But in terms of the issues that are before us now, the effectiveness of counsel at that second proceeding is not
right
before us.
And I'm not saying she was ineffective. In fact, quite frankly, given all the demands on her time, I'm quite impressed with what effort she made. And she did ask for additional time. It's not as though she gave up and didn't even try to contact the individuals. So I'm making no claim of ineffective assistance on her part. The question I was responding to is, what is the prejudice given that these matters were submitted? And so I guess what I'm trying to do is draw the court's attention to those clemency matters. Read what the defense counsel said in her submission, because I think it clarifies that that she wanted time to get those statements, to present them to the convening authority, and she was denied the time to do that. And so the prejudice basically continues through that process from the original proceeding.
Now, with respect to the claim of ineffectiveness at the trial in the calling of the victim, as a general matter, not with respect to the facts in this case, is it per se ineffective for a defense counsel as a matter of strategy to call a witness when there's been a statement admitted from both the accused and that witness victim, and the defense counsel makes a strategic decision that live testimony from the victim witness would be a useful way to diminish the effect of the charges, even if it results in adverse testimony as to some of those charges? I'm not asking you to concede anything with respect to this case. I'm asking whether there is a per se ineffectiveness when this type of tactic is used.
No, sir. I don't claim any kind of per se ineffectiveness in that instance. I'm sure there's some hypothetical factual situation out there where that would make, could make some sense. But it's a very risky tactic and requires close scrutiny, I think, by the appellate courts when it occurs.
Well, we have a risky tactic and close scrutiny, so now we're here. What did this defense counsel do in employing that tactic in this case that rendered this counsel out of bounds, as is required under the first prong of Strickland, so ineffective that the defense was operating without the effective counsel?
Well, the one, of course, I've already mentioned one, that he basically brought out evidence from her. For instance,
Didn't you say that evidence was already before the court in terms of her written statement?
Right. Well, for instance, she only made claims of sexual intercourse at Fort Hood. As I read that statement, she did not make any claims of indecent acts or sodomy at Fort Hood. It seemed that my client brought out those things when he brought her in and examined her. Now, in my mind, it's somewhat inexplicable why the court found my client not guilty, and it certainly, I'm not sure what the logic was by the defense counsel in that respect, but
well, if sexual intercourse charged as rape?
Yes.
And the would it not be an appropriate defense tactic to say, no, this wasn't rape, it was another sexual act?
Well, if you have some expert testimony to back up that this was a consensual situation, I think the problem here was
not even consensual. I mean, given the difference between rape and other sexual offenses, both in terms of the maximum punishments and the impact on the sentencing authority, why couldn't that be a valid tactic? The statement by the individual says sexual intercourse, which was charged as rape. Then why can't the defense counsel then bring in the person who made the statement to say it was something else?
Well, I don't think she was saying it was something else. She was saying we had sexual intercourse, and on cross-examination, when the government, I think, asked for the trial counsel, which he would not have been able to do on cross-examination if she hadn't been brought in, asked if she said no or asked him to stop, and she said she did. So basically, the defense counsel had no other evidence through expert testimony to establish that kind of theory, if that's where he was going. The problem we had in this case is that you have rape ranging from the period when she was, allegations of rape when she was about 10 years old. And at least, you know, I've litigated a lot of these cases, and usually you bring in an expert if you're going to try to claim that this was a consensual situation as opposed to something else. But the defense counsel basically, through his questioning, brought out facts and otherwise got her to basically adopt her statement. I mean, in many respects, she adopted her statement. There were very few points where she differed from that statement. And then the trial counsel, on cross-examination, basically was able to come in and fill in the gaps in his case regarding consent and issues of that sort. So, and I tried to look for some discernible strategy. And part of the problem was the defense counsel, by not making an opening statement, gave no insight into to where he was going with this thing. I mean, he made no opening statement at the beginning saying, here's our theory of the case, and here's a roadmap, and here's where we're going. And apparently, even at the point where he was prepared to call her as a witness, he waived his opening statement. And at that point, he could have articulated some kind of rationale or basis, clear basis for why he was calling her.
Is it your view that the rationale is wholly missing from the closing argument as well?
Well, the closing argument, yes, I would say that, simply because at this point he's basically conceding that sexual intercourse took place at Fort Hood. Now, if my client pled guilty to rape at Fort Hood, he would have gone through a providency inquiry to make sure he was making a knowing plea. And this is, you know, I understand the government's case is, well, where's the prejudice? I mean, there's a confession. He said they had sexual intercourse three times at Fort Wainwright. What's the big deal here? Well, the big deal is basically his attorney seems to be conceding that there was sexual intercourse, a key element of an offense of rape at Fort Hood, when my client in his confession did not admit any such intercourse at Fort Hood. So, and to me, for an attorney to basically concede a rape in so many words, you know, he doesn't come out, I mean, he tries to say, well, this is just common knowledge, but I mean, there just really is no, if he really had that argument, he should have supported it with more evidence. And so, essentially, my client's sitting there having his attorneys vouch for her credibility. Put on evidence of misconduct that wasn't in her statement, and then ultimately say, well, court, you know, it only happened one time at Fort Hood, as opposed to diverse occasions. And so I think at that point, and with no discernible strategy articulated by the attorney, I think that that falls below the competency level expected of an attorney, and it's a breakdown in the adversarial process, quite frankly.
But your issue doesn't include the fact that he didn't make an opening statement.
Well,
you're not challenging that in your case.
Right. I mean, it's there in the record, and it, in terms of answering the court, hey, what's the strategy of the defense here? I'm saying I can't discern it.
You're not attacking that. You didn't attack that in your brief as part of the ineffective assistance of counsel.
It was not brought up in my brief. I don't know, because it is in the record, that I'm precluded from raising it now. I'm reading the clock right. I've only got about 30 seconds. I mean,
you may conclude, and you'll have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. I am Captain Magdalena Acevedo, and along with Colonel John Miller, I represent the government in this case. Appellant received effective assistance of counsel at every stage of his court-martial and in the post-trial action, and this court should affirm appellant's conviction and sentence. There is a reasonable tactical explanation for counsel's decision to call Bianca, the victim, as a defense witness. At that point in the court-martial, over defense objection, the military judge had already admitted not only appellant's confession, but Bianca's sworn statement detailing years of sexual molestation and rape at the hands of appellant. This information was further corroborated by appellant's wife, who had several years before caught appellant in a compromising situation with his stepdaughter, and at which time Bianca made the first allegation of sexual molestation. Given the overwhelming evidence against appellant, the defense counsel's only option was to mitigate the damage. Particularly given appellant's confession, defense counsel could not argue that these acts did not happen. And the strategy worked. When defense counsel called Bianca to the stand, she backtracked heavily on her CID confession. She downplayed her statement. She denied some of the sexual acts, insisted upon never threatened her, and even criticized CID and accused CID of pressuring her into alleging more conduct than happened. And there was also a resulting beneficial effect to appellant on the findings. Because of the defense counsel's strategy, appellant was found guilty in conformity more of Bianca's testimony in trial than her damning statement that she gave to CID.
What would she have been found guilty? What would he have been found guilty of that she specifically exonerated him of in her testimony?
Your Honor, he was, as a result of her testimony, he was found not guilty of specific language and indecent acts at Fort Wainwright and Fort Leonard Wood, completely not guilty of committing indecent acts at Fort Hood, completely not guilty of committing sodomy at Fort Hood, and only guilty of one occasion of rape at Fort Hood, instead of the rapes that she claimed in her statement occurred 4 to 5 times per week. The defense counsel's strategy worked. It was the best option available to the defense at that point, given the overwhelming nature of the evidence. Counsel did not err, but rather presented a sound and effective trial strategy. And it's also important for this court to note that nowhere in the appellant's brief does he claim any type of prejudice, any type of effect on the findings. Appellant has not only failed to show prejudice, leaving this court the option to not even look at whether there was an effective assistance of counsel, but has also failed to meet any of the prongs under Strickland for an effective assistance of counsel. With regard to sentencing, appellant's current allegation that his defense counsel should have called more witnesses is laughable in light of his statement at his court-martial to the military judge that not only did he not want any more witnesses to be called, but that his attorney did not forget anything. On page 825 of the record, the military judge had a colloquy with appellant and instructed appellant to specifically consult with his client to see if any more sentencing matters should be presented. Additionally, there was no need to recall First Sergeant Wright. His testimony was already in front of the finder of fact for both merits and for sentencing. Appellant not only doesn't claim what else First Sergeant Wright could have testified to, but there's no evidence at all that he would have presented anything new. And as this court held in Moulton, it is appellant's burden to show not only what other witnesses could have been called, but what in fact they would have testified to. First Sergeant Wright's testimony was already considered, and the defense counsel actually referenced that testimony in his argument on the sentence. Additionally, defense counsel presented other evidence of appellant's military character ignored by appellant. Defense counsel used another government witness, Captain Stonehacker, to introduce evidence of appellant's military character and military bearing while these charges were pending. And appellant spent his full unsworn statement, spanning 10 pages of the record, going in detail about every step of his military career. Ultimately, appellant's military character was not at issue here. Due to the gravity of the charges, defense counsel called the two best witnesses he could have called. He called appellant's wife, who testified that she could not make it financially on her own. And even more importantly, defense counsel called the victim to testify that she did not want appellant to go to jail. There were no stronger witnesses than that, Your Honor. Again, under Moulton, it is appellant's responsibility to identify the witnesses and to say what those witnesses would have testified to. Appellant has again failed in his burden. Additionally, again, appellant does not claim any prejudice resulting from his alleged deficiency. Defense counsel not only did not commit any error in sentencing, but again presented the best testimony that he could have. With regards to the post-trial processing, as was pointed out earlier, defense counsel again does not claim any prejudice, nor is there any prejudice, since appellant received a new post-trial action and had another chance to submit clemency matters. Additionally, appellant again fails to meet his burden. In United States v. Pierce, this court clearly said that when an appellant alleges that different evidence should have been presented in clemency, that appellant has the burden to show what should have been submitted. Apart from vague assertions, appellant has failed to show even a deficiency here. Ultimately, appellant received effective assistance of counsel during the merits, during the sentencing, and in post-trial action of this case. Unless there are any further questions, we conclude. Looking at trial defense counsel's performance at every stage of the proceeding, there is no doubt that appellant received effective assistance of counsel and that he has now failed to meet his burden to show any deficiency. As such, this court should affirm the Army Court's decision and approve the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
If I understand what trial counsel is saying, or government appellate counsel is saying, we're basically saying if a defense counsel does not communicate with their client after trial, makes no communication, returns no phone calls, does not respond to an accused wife, even though he's locked in jail. It's not like he can get him, you know, get out of USDB and walk down to the attorney's office and say, hey, what are we doing for clemency? My client did everything he could to find out what his attorney was doing for him in clemency. And basically all he got was a closed door and a stone wall.
Let's assume, counsel, that post-trial counsel at both the first and second proceedings was ineffective, and I know you're not making that argument as to the second proceeding. How do we address the second prong of Strickland then?
Well, I mean, here that is a challenge in terms of how do you point to what would have happened if he had submitted other matters. And this is a very subjective area of law. I mean, quite frankly, you have some convening authorities who are known for granting clemency in circumstances even against their staff judge advocate, just on the barest assertions by defense. In other cases, you have wonderful clemency packages, and I'm talking about the real world now, Your Honor. I live in the real world as a trial lawyer, and the real world is that there are other community authorities that, despite glowing clemency packages, give no clemency whatsoever. So it's part of the challenge in terms of trying to establish a show of prejudice is that it's a very subjective kind of process.
Well, we live in the world of appellate judges, and I'll let others decide how to characterize that. But one of the things that we'll focus on is what would the convening authority have had to consider.
My client said he gave a list of names to Mr. Woodward before trial. In his affidavit, he says that these people said they were willing to testify as to his involvement in church, as to his work. In his unsworn statement, he identified a lot of the things that he did as a soldier. These people, I think the government, quite frankly, appears to be conceding that my client was an outstanding soldier. So in terms of showing prejudice, I think it's a matter of people said they were willing to provide affidavits. The government seems to concede that he had an outstanding record as a soldier. And these people, had they been contacted and called as witnesses, would have supplied statements. One of the challenges faced...
But we don't have before us those specifics, do we?
Right. And one of the reasons is because years after an event, it's very difficult to track people down. This case reversed this court reversed a conviction of one of my prior clients. The government dropped the charges, remaining charges that stood against him because they couldn't find the witnesses.
Right. Counsel, caution against any kind of testimony here, just focusing on the record in this case.
Right.
Please correct me if I'm mistaken, but there is nothing in the record of this case demonstrating that specific individuals could not be reached.
Is that
accurate?
That is accurate. There's nothing in the record. What is in the record is that the defense counsel who attempted to submit clemency matters the second time said she had a list of names to contact, and the convening authority basically said, sorry, the clock has run out. We're not going to allow you to contact these people. Now, to the extent that she was making efforts to contact them and could not contact them, I don't know that she put in the record whether they could even be located.
As I read the petition supplement, that's not part of the record here.
Right. And that's why I was saying I didn't know if she had commented on that specifically. So it may have been that she did attempt to contact them, was not able to locate them. That's why she needed more time. But that may not be part of the record. I guess what I'm arguing is that in a case of this nature, even though there may be no per se rule, and in a case where the government has not attempted to even obtain from Mr. Woodward an affidavit indicating if he made any efforts at all to contact witnesses, and in a case where oftentimes it's months if not years before these things get fleshed out at the appellate level, and witnesses and people too disappear and go different places, and in a case where it is so subjective clemency process, that to hold the accused who's sitting in jail and has limited resources to that kind of standard and showing prejudice is an unreasonable standard. And so I guess I would ask the court in this case, if that is a stumbling block, to carve out an exception for those cases where the facts are so egregious, in my opinion, where a defense counsel has failed to even contact. I mean, here are the facts that are egregious. Army TDS lawyer tells civilian counsel before trial, give me a list of character witnesses my client gave you. I'll do it. What happens? Attorney goes to my client and for who knows whatever reason says, fire your TDS attorney. And he releases him.
What you're basically arguing for, counsel, is a per se ineffectiveness.
Well, not per se, but I think we deal with direct evidence and circumstantial evidence. And I think the inferences here are clear and fair and can be drawn, even at the appellate level in the absence of statements from other individuals. Just by what was put together by the TDS lawyer in the second go-around, I think there's a clear inference that my client did not get effective representation the first go-around. Why didn't the first attorney do what she did the second go-around? The other thing is that his case, it took that much longer to process on appellate review because the Army Court sent it back for this Staff Judge Advocate recommendation on an issue that wasn't even raised by the appellant. And ultimately procured my client no meaningful relief but further delay in the appellate process. And so, and even the judge, she mentions the judge asked my client and he said that he didn't want to present any more evidence. The military judge in 25 says, I know that you've talked to Mr. Woodward about this, but I just want to know if there's something that was forgotten. Do you want to take a moment to discuss with Ms. Brown and Mr. Woodward if maybe there's something else out there? And And there's no indication that they took a recess. And I may not have the full page, but in any event, my experience has been that oftentimes, and I'm not saying this is evidence, I'm just saying I think this is knowledge of the ways of the world and the way it operates. When a client is sitting there and he looks at his attorney and the attorney says, we have no other evidence, and he's in the process of being sentenced after being found guilty, they're somewhat dumbstruck. And so while the government wants to say, well, that was a knowing kind of affirmative re-waiving the right to present any documents, and I do not accept that as that kind of statement from my client, and I think that's an unreasonable inference to draw. On the other hand, I think it is a reasonable inference to draw that had Mr. Woodward interviewed, called, contacted witnesses both within the community at Fort Hood and at my client's previous assignments, at the time when he was preparing for trial and it was clear that was one of the requirements that he should be complying with, he failed to do so. At least there's no evidence that he did so. And so it's in this context and in the fact that there are, apparently it's clear from my client's record that he had a good record, it is fair to infer that it would not have taken much to scratch the surface to bring in witnesses both in sentencing and in the clemency stage. I mean, basically, if this court says what happened here is okay, the court is saying that there's no requirement for a defense counsel to contact or communicate with his clients essentially after trial, that that's effective assistance of counsel. And I think the court would be turning a blind eye to what is clear evidence that my client had a strong record as a soldier, which is, it's shown in glimpses and pieces, it's shown in my client's own sworn statement, but it would be turning a blind eye to the fact that people would have testified as to those facts. And to recognize the reality of tracking down witnesses after so many years is a very, very difficult process.
Counsel, I believe your time has expired. If you'd like to make a concluding remark.
Well, we believe that we have established both ineffective assistance and prejudice to my client, and that relief is warranted by setting aside the findings and the sentence in this case.
Thank you. Again, we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.